So I thought we could take this opportunity to have a session of questions and perhaps a few answers. And then we'll break again for a few minutes and come back for our last sitting together before the end of the day. So if anyone has a question, and if you're sitting right at the back and you have a question and I can't see you, it'll be very hard for me to answer you because I like to look right at you. And this helps me to answer the question. Otherwise, I'm just imagining the person that I'm talking to. So if you have a question and I can't see you, please come forward and ask your question. Thank you. Anyone? Yes.
Is it the case that the most senior nun has to bow to the most junior monk?
Does this disturb you? Oh, sorry, I should repeat the question. The question is it the case that the most senior nun has to bow to the most junior monk?
I imagine myself going into monastic order, and I was just visualizing powerful resentment about that.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And how many of you would be disturbed by that? That's so interesting. Well, I'm not disturbed by it. And there's a whole history involved in that. And, you know, the Buddha offered us so many rules which serve for us as a safety net. And many of them are conventional, and many of them are ethical. And the ethical rules are really, really important. And the convention was established over 2.5 millennia ago, the conventions and the major convention and the minor ones. But we keep the whole package out of respect for the Buddha. Now there's so many other things I can add to help you to understand that the hierarchy is not an evil thing. It's actually helpful. Somebody has to go first. I think if the woman went first, it would never work. Because I think that for the men to bow to the women across the board would cause more problems. It certainly would never have worked at the time of the Buddha. Never. And he had to consider that as a leader. Women in the time of the Buddha were not valued, didn't have legal rights or rights as women have today. Rape was very common. There was not a lot of security or safety. Women didn't own property. I don't think they had any aspirations for independence. But what the Buddha did offer everyone unilaterally, unequivocally, was the ability to gain freedom from suffering. And everything else, including gender, is just gender is an attribute of the body. It is not an attribute of the mind. This is a very important thing for us to contemplate when we get worried about who goes first or who bows to who. So the Buddha was a practical teacher of gods and humans and kings and paupers, men and women. He established the fourfold Sangha. It's like the four corners of the earth, north, south, east, west, perfectly balanced. And over time, the women's order disappeared because women could not protect themselves. And when the invasions occurred in Sri Lanka over 1,000 years ago, the monks could not defend the nuns and they couldn't defend themselves, and they disappeared. However, there remained fully ordained nuns in Asia that had originally been ordained in Taiwan by nuns that had come from Sri Lanka. So the line, the direct line from the Buddha's own dispensation, from the elder's tradition, was never broken. And that has been the reason we've been able to restore the female fold. And it is with great joy that we sit here today with you, the three Theravada nuns in Canada. It's just starting after so many centuries. But this isn't something we've made up. This is something that we received from the Buddha himself, and we don't receive it based on our own ignorant ideas. We're not fully enlightened. We don't understand the delicacy, the intricacy of this system and the reasoning from which it arose. We don't have that perspective. So this is a case of you trust the teacher and you unconditionally receive the gift of the training. And if you don't receive it fully, then don't take it. Because you can't train if you have any pride. Well, I know better. I don't think I should be bowing to those monks. But I don't know better. And what I do know is that from the very first time I was asked in England in 1990, I was interviewed by someone from the BBC, and it was BBC Radio. He came to the monastery and he asked me, "How do you feel about bowing to the men?" And I said, what I said to you, I didn't think it would work the other way. I said that I have pride. All of us who are not fully enlightened have pride. We have a sense of conceit. You know, if we're not aware of it, we just have to look closely and we'll see what comes up in the mind when we're in a situation and somebody says, "Oh, you don't know what you're doing," or insults us. You know, pride comes up. Or else it's a inferiority conceit where we feel terrible. He's right, or it's true, I'm no good, blah, blah, blah. This is still conceit. And bowing is the most wonderful practice. That's why we love bowing. You know, we bow to our teacher every day. We bow to our seniors, our elders. We bow to other people when they are angry. We bow by offering forgiveness. That's a way of just making peace. This is how it is. And it's a skillful means for uprooting and working with slowly the forces of ill will in the heart, which come from conceit, whether it's superiority or inferiority or just a sense of self. This is how ignorance takes root in the mind and is in control, or is the way that we work and live and guide ourselves. I don't want to live and work and be guided by ignorance. I want to wake up. So I know that bowing to the monks has been, for me, just a practice. It's a practice. And you practice just letting go and not being concerned. What could be more beautiful than paying respect? But if you're bowing with resentment, don't take this training. Because we have to learn to bow to the things that we don't like. But we can still respect them as a teaching. Like when somebody is mean to us, we can say, that person is mean, and blame them and criticize them. But the most important thing is happening in that interaction, that the unkindness can be responded to by blaming, feeling angry, feeling resentful, or by saying, that's not skillful, I don't want to do that, I can forgive that, I will not follow that. And that, then we can be respectful to the person rather than being resentful. And so I'll tell you a story about bowing to monks. And it could be, I don't mean to say bowing to monks like in a pejorative way at all. And you'll understand when I explain. I lived in Penang for some time. And one day I was invited to a meal at a temple. And the meal was in honor of a friend's mother who had died. So it was a dana, like we did today. And she wanted me to be present to help chant the blessing for her mother. When I arrived at the temple gate, dressed in these robes, the monk, the abbot, was standing outside the gate. And he looked at me and he said, "Female?" Very angry. And even if I wasn't in robes, I would have been shocked. Because I was just a human being. I wanted to come into the temple. And the attribute of my body was the main phenomena that caught his attention. So it was very wrong. And I knew it was very wrong. And I was shaken by that. So what I noticed, and thanks to my practice and my training, what I noticed was the tightness in my body, and you know, I tremble anyway, but this was, I was shaking. And I felt a little off-center, like, how do I respond to this? I'm attending a dana. Do I have to subject myself to this kind of treatment? But I felt that I had to attend this event and be there for my friend's memorial for her mother. So I walked into the temple, and the abbot had already gone in. I didn't know what would happen, but I went in, and he was sitting in his seat. Usually the abbot has a high seat. And I'd been a nun for many years, like 18 years I think at that time. I went up to the seat and I bowed. And part of me was going, why are you bowing? He's, you know, and I ignored that. I just ignored that and I said, no, I'm going to bow. Why are you bowing? I'm bowing because this monk is in the robe, just like me. He took the robe with the aspiration to be enlightened. I've taken the robe with the aspiration to be enlightened. He has not acted skillfully. I must act skillfully. I forgive his unskillful action and I bow, because that's the convention. It was the most beautiful thing, because then I didn't bow with resentment. I bowed with compassion. And he sat there completely frozen. He couldn't say a word. He just looked at me with almost terror. It was scary for him. What is she doing? And then he ordered me to go sit with the lay women. So I went and said, no, oh, by the way, the lay people were all witness to this. I wasn't alone. And I went and sat down. And then the lay women were not happy with this, so they took a rug and set it up in the front where the monks were sitting, but not right next to them, just in the front, separate. And then they offered the food. I sat on the ground, on that mat, but on the ground, eating out of my bowl. The monks sat at a table, eating out of plates. And the lay people rejoiced. I joined them. They chanted, and I just chanted with them. And they couldn't stop me, because the lay people supported the correct procedure. I felt very protected. And her mother received due honor and blessing. And the monks just did what they did, unaware of, you know, this different kind of practice. And I left with a teaching, a great teaching, which is, it doesn't matter how other people hold the convention, it matters how I hold it. So there will always be people who will be unkind, disrespectful, even if they're wearing the robe. And it's a shame, but there's so many shames in this world. So why should I bow to the shame? I will bow to what I honor in those people and in myself. And that is love, compassion, rejoicing in the goodness when it's there, and being equanimous when it's not. I wasn't equanimous to start with, but I sorted it out in my heart. So I'm so grateful to the Buddha's training. If I didn't have to bow to that monk, I wouldn't have bowed to him, probably. I was upset. But because I had to bow, not had to, but I've been trained, this is the correct form. Sometimes the form has such a power that it gives you the opportunity to see your own stuff. It creates a container within which we can face our worst enemy. And what is our worst enemy? Whatever garbage is floating around, it's in here. The outside garbage we have no control over it, as we can see with climate change. We have no control. But we can govern our own conduct and speech. That we can control, restrain. Here, the measure of my own well-being is the measure of my ability to practice and restrain and bring up good qualities, wholesome qualities, loving kindness, compassion, and offer that. Otherwise, what meaning is there in my life? Even if the monks walk behind me, I wouldn't learn that lesson. And they have another practice, which is to support something that is not being supported. And there are monks that are so respectful to us. And it doesn't matter that we come behind them. It doesn't matter. If it matters, then the practice is not working. It's the bottom line. Thank you for your question. Yes?
You say that you root klesha or obscuration is the Sanskrit word avidya or ignorance.
Avidya is, sorry, the word klesha or?
No, the word is avidya. Avidya. Which means ignorance.
Yes, and klesha is another word, it means defilement. The defilements are obstructions. Avijja is the root, and from avijja comes craving, tanha. And craving leads to the mind wanting, it leads to a feeling of greed and wanting things from the world and desire. It leads to becoming and birth. And pain and grief and despair and lamentation and all those things. So, did you have a question?
When you talk about mindfulness and practice of mindfulness, so presuming that practice goes on all day and you're combating a sort of kind of thinking, but there's another kind of thinking that the Buddha obviously engaged in. How do you put that into the creative, contemplative thinking? You're not supposed to make it.
I think...
repeat the question.
Yeah, I didn't really hear everything you said. I wonder if you could come closer and if you don't mind repeating your question.
I guess to put it simply, I was just saying, how do you distinguish the creative, forward thinking that leads to enlightenment and the monkey mind thinking. If you are in a mindful situation throughout your conscious day.
Well, if you're mindful of monkey mind, there's a kind of, you know, one of the wrong forms of speech is sambapalapa, which is a useless gossip, chit-chat, and that monkey mind is a similar one, but it's inaudible to the rest of the world. But it's in here. It's just like the, you know, the enemy is not out there, it's in here. So if we're mindful of that, then we can press the off button to that, and we can use skillful speech. So skillful thought, just like skillful speech, is speech that is harmonious and nonviolent and righteous, ethical speech, kind speech, not swearing, not accusative. That I don't mean a tense, I mean not accusing, not blaming. Forgiving. Now, when I say that, I have to be more specific, but I don't want to wander away from answering your question. So, when we reflect wisely in our minds, then we are using wise inner speech. So these are thoughts that don't lead to desiring and to greed, to ill will, to confusion, but they're thoughts that bring us closer to understanding the truth of what we are and to develop good habits of speech and conduct through steadying the mind and through developing mental states which are wakeful, conscientious, morally whole, compassionate, balanced, contented, grateful, concentrated, and clear, able to see things as they are, able to understand the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, the delusory quality of most mental phenomena. But there is one, I should say all mental phenomena, but one and that is the unconditioned. That's what we're all hoping to know and realize. Yes. Sorry, did I answer your question? Well done.
How do one prepare ourselves to become a nun, and when do you know that is the right time?
That's a very lovely question. How does one prepare to become a nun, and when does not one know the right time? I think you should come and see us. And maybe after the session. It's quite a specific topic. I think all of us have a monk and nun in us. And when you want to make a 24/7 commitment to developing the paramis and the factors of enlightenment, and you're ready to give up the delights of the world, then certainly do come to the monastery. But don't think that the monastery is just a way of getting away from the world, because what you'll find is that you bring the world with you. Everyone who comes to live in the monastery brings all their stuff with them. And then all of us get to work on it. Yes, anyone?
Could you talk a bit about, you talked about reflecting, could you talk a bit about investigation and maybe how they're different or the same or go together? I'm completely confused about those two terms.
Right. I think the best way to do it is practically to understand that the difference between reflecting and investigating. So, investigating and reflecting are quite similar, and I don't think you should worry too much about words, because it's in wordlessness that the mind will know if there is a difference or not. I'm not a linguist here. So for me, reflecting wisely is, by the way, please listen with your heart. And, one of my teachers told me this, just put the pen down and don't be attached to writing things down, because you won't receive here. And even if you only remember one word that helps, that will be enough. You need not write it all down. I like it if you can just... I don't bring notes, you know. I just come from here, and I think it's good to listen from here. For me, it's just a true offering, and I don't expect you to remember much. You know, just feel, just if you can feel some warmth in your heart, that's good enough. So I think we tend as Westerners to be quite intellectual and read a lot and disconnect from the heart. But I think this little area here just needs to open more and more and more. But I respect the intention to really digest and receive. I'm just offering that as a suggestion. So reflecting, wisely reflecting, is a way of digesting. For example, And you've heard something, something's happened, and it doesn't sit well with you, and you need to find a way through it. When that monk was so inhospitable to me, I reflected on aspiration, on the meaning of the robe, my love of the robe, my wish to honor the form and show respect. And there was a cognitive dissonance there, because the treatment I received did not represent the robe as I know it and as I would like to see it. So I reflected on what were my options, what could I do to properly respond, to be true to my aspiration and my training, because I feel like an ambassador to the Buddha. So if I were to respond unwell or unwisely, I would feel that I had not properly or represented the Buddha in a gracious way, in a true way. That would be a form of reflecting. Investigating is, you can also reflect and investigate, but the way I think of investigation is you try to examine in a deep way, in a true way, what is going on. And in the examination, we use effort and we use mindfulness. We try to see the breath, for example. How is the breath? Supposing you start to feel palpitations when you're watching the breath. And the first association I would have with palpitations is, I'm having an acid reflux attack. And then I might start to think, oh, what did I eat? You know, and then you're not investigating anymore. You've gotten distracted by your diagnosis. But real investigation will go deeper than that. Acid reflux, never mind. Feel it, what is it? Is it a pounding? Is it regular? Is it irregular? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it loud? Is it minimal? Is it painful? It's probably not pleasant. But is it unbearable? Or is it bearable? So it could be minimally painful or just unbearable. Is it frightening? And if it is frightening, then to maybe begin to investigate the fear. Not the palpitation, but the fear associated with it. Well, what does that feel like? The fear is a constriction, a tightening of the whole body, which might exacerbate the palpitation. Then you really think you're having a heart attack. But actually, we're having a fear attack. So investigation will give us a better reading of our experience than just a cursory examination or a cursory view. Reflecting might not be appropriate if it's just sitting back, oh yeah, palpitations, big deal. You know, as our job as meditators is to look deeply and closely at our experience and examine it in the truest light possible. If we only look at the superficial layer, well, we do that every day. And we've been doing that for lifetimes. And we really need to go deeper than that. That's one way of speaking to that. Yes.
I'm curious to know where the monastery is in Ontario and what your life is like on a daily basis, how you connect to the community around you.
Oh, how lovely. I have a card here. And I'd like to give it to you. Maybe you'll come visit us. I have a few cards. to give.
Mail cards?
Sorry?
Mails,
yes. We do have a small, we're only a new seedling in this country, and we have a tiny house and a beautiful temple. So the accommodation isn't very big, and we do have a small area for men. You have to book well in advance, because it's usually women come and there's not much space for them either.
Not
so.
Much space for men.
There is a monk's monastery close by, and you could go and stay there for a long period. Yeah, yeah. So, does that answer your question? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you wanted to know what our life is like?
Yes, and where it is.
We're in Perth, Ontario. And if you really want to know what our life is like, please come and visit us. But you would have to be able to keep 8 precepts. Do you know about the 8? You do? Okay. So that means no dinner. Big lunch, but I've never been hungry in Canada. I have been hungry in other countries, and that's why I'm here. Yes. I was in a Western country. I don't want to name it because it might make people feel uncomfortable. It was just conditions, karma. I was meant to come back to this country where I was born and raised. So I was in a non-Buddhist culture, and people, very good intentions, they didn't want me to go hungry, but there was just not the awareness of the situation I was in. So sometimes people signed up to bring a meal and forgot. Or there was a period of time where there weren't enough people signing up, and I would eat more breakfast. Instead of another meal, I would just have more of the breakfast that was given. And it was quite scary. In fact, you know, just as with the bowing, the hunger is a teacher. So I didn't like being hungry. But there was one time when it really got to me, and someone didn't show up with the meal. And it was on a day when I didn't have much recourse. And I think I was hungry from the day before. So I just started to feel self-pity. Like people don't value what I'm doing. They don't care about me. Have you ever heard these kind of voices? And I think that I was more hungry in my mind than in my body. My heart was hungry. I sat in front of my shrine and tears were rolling down my cheeks, and I thought, I can't do this. I need to be fed. You know, it went on and on like that. And then suddenly, I looked at the Buddha statue on the shrine, and I remembered that when I became a nun, I took lifetime vows that I would be a nun for the rest of my life. That was the condition under which my teacher gave me the precepts. So suddenly I remembered that. And this is the value of training. It's if you have made a promise, and you're the type of person that will not break a promise, then that promise is like a safety. It's the way the tracks are for a train. You know, it just keeps it in line. So I remembered my vow, and I just shot up straight and thought, I have to keep doing this. I made this commitment, and I've got to find a way, and I can do this. Of course I can do this. Suddenly, all those silly, shabby voices fell silent in front of my vow. They just lay down. And there was no problem. I was back on track. Wiped my tears, just sat there with gratitude, and I realized I did not take this commitment on condition that the Buddha feed me. In fact, I made an unconditional vow to be a nun forever. And it's like when you get married and you say, until death do us part. Now somebody's going to ask me a question, and I know what that question would be. But I tell you, being married to the Buddha is the most wholesome wedding of all. There's nothing greater than that, male or female. It's not about gender, it's about genderlessness. It's about selflessness. Selfishness is overcome. So it's unselfish. There's no more concern about self. It's a complete generosity of heart. It's a complete giving over to that which is true, right, pure, and whole. What could be more wonderful, beautiful? Yes.
Is there a requirement that you're vegetarian, and if so, how does that work with
The vegetarian question has come up. The Buddha was not a vegetarian. I've reflected on this a lot. And during the Buddha's time, he was challenged by his cousin Devadatta, who insisted that he make a rule that the monks be vegetarian, or that the monastics be vegetarian. And the Buddha said, no, that wouldn't be suitable. He didn't say it would be right or wrong, he said it wouldn't be suitable. And many people think that vegetarianism is a better practice. One of the answers I give people as a kind of short form answer is, it doesn't matter what goes into your mouth, it matters what comes out of your mouth. So people can be vegetarians, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to speak well, act well, be kind, be gentle, be true, be wise. But they're vegetarian. So I think that to be vegetarian, as well as to be perfected or purifying one's virtue is lovely, but to deny people the right to offer what they have is not so beautiful. And that's where the conflict is. If you go to a poor fishing village and you want to spread the Dhamma, and the fishermen, their livelihood is fish, and they put a fish in your bowl, well, what would you do? say, no, I don't eat fish. Oh, they cannot practice generosity to support our life and to gain the goodness of that, the joy of that. I would feel very sad. When I was a young man, I had been a vegetarian for about 17 years, and I didn't take the nun's training on the condition that I be a vegetarian, or even that I get fed, as I just told you. So we have our alms bowl, and in our tradition we eat whatever is offered. And if we decide not to eat what's in the bowl, then that's okay, but at least receive it. Now, if that means that you're not going to eat anything, that would be foolhardy, because then we wouldn't be looking after our bodies. One time when I was living in New Zealand, I stood outside of a bakery. Days a week, I you didn't let me finish the sentence. 6 days a week I relied on people coming with a meal, and one day a week I would walk in the town and receive alms, and the alms, it means receive food. So I would usually stand in front of a place where food was sold, because in a Christian culture it was hard enough for people to understand what you were doing, let alone for them to realize what would be beautiful for them to do. So it was just practical. And on this particular day, it was late. I was very cold. It was the cold season, and I was standing on a concrete sidewalk, and nothing was coming in. People were just hurrying by, hurrying in, hurrying out, or walking past and not even seeing me. I think one person tried to offer money, and I put my hand over the bowl and said, I don't receive money. But then suddenly this man came out of the bakery, and he bowed on the ground on the cold concrete. He bowed and paid respects, and he put this package into my bowl, and I could smell it. And it was warm, and I knew that it was a meat pie. So right away, because I was trying to be a vegetarian, still hanging on to that one, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I'm hungry and cold. And I thought, well, I will eat the crust, and I will feed the birds with the meat. And it so happened that as I turned, because it was already getting time to go, I have to finish before noon, and so we use solar noon, but now that's 1 o'clock, but generally it's noon, so I had to have time to finish the meal. And as I turned to walk down to the park, somebody put a banana in my bowl. So I had a banana and crust, and I fed the meat to the birds. But if I didn't have crust and a banana, I would have eaten the meat. Nowadays, I just eat what is offered, and I bless the food, and I also try to reflect that the animal has given its life, not specifically for me, because we are forbidden to eat meat that was destroyed for our meal. But if it's already dead, then we're allowed to eat it. It depends also on what kind of meat there are many meats that are forbidden. Now in our day and age, animals are kept in cruel ways, sometimes tortured and beaten, and I've seen documentaries, and it's unbelievable. You wouldn't want to touch meat after seeing these images. But because people come with their hearts full of love and respect and well-wishing, and they want to support what we're doing, I tried to follow what the Buddha did. I just receive the food with gratitude. I try to receive it with love in my heart, no matter what it is. You know, even if, I remember once someone came to my door in New Zealand, quite elderly woman, she rode her bicycle and showed up, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm late." She came to offer the breakfast, and she said, I didn't know what to bring, so I looked in the freezer and there was some stale bread. So I've toasted it for you." And that was my meal. I didn't get anything else. And that was one of the days, it was a bad day, where I had this critical mind. I thought, stale bread. You know, I felt, you know, self-pity, like, is that all that she could bring? And that was such a not beautiful mind state with which to receive the food, that I actually didn't feel worthy of the bread. Even though it was, you know, I just didn't feel worthy in myself of receiving what she had. She didn't have a problem with it. Now in the monastery we regularly eat stale bread and we toast it and it's great. We really like it. Oh, it was such a teaching for me.
Do all three of you observe this rule?
Yes.
That reminds me, many decades ago I read about a story where Buddha's senior monks was begging from a leper, and a leper's a finger fell out of the bowl full of hot. You heard about that? I guess you had to eat it, right?
Right. Well, we don't eat human flesh.
Oh, I agree.
No. But if it was mixed into the food and you can't pull it out, I don't know. If he knew, he might have not eaten it.
Sorry?
He might not have eaten it. Did you say he ate it?
I'm pretty sure he did,
yeah. Well, yes.
Could you mention the benefits we receive from offering food?
Maybe I should let you give that talk.
So what was the question?
What are the benefits that the laity receive from making offerings? Well, as Visakha, one of the disciples of the Buddha, she was very, very generous, and she spoke to the Buddha about the joy that she received from making offerings. And the benefit of that is that when we make an offering, like if you give someone a gift and you give it with so much joy in your heart, then your body becomes relaxed. And when your body is relaxed, then your mind becomes relaxed. When your mind is relaxed, it becomes joyful and peaceful. When the mind is full of joy and peace, then you can meditate well. When you meditate well, then you can cultivate the seven factors of enlightenment and the Eightfold Path and the four foundations of mindfulness, and develop the five mental faculties, the five powers, the four Yidis, the 32 Bodhipakya Dhamma. Then you can realize enlightenment, and the benefits are immeasurable, basically. That's what Visakha discovered, and that's what not exactly what she said to the Buddha, but pretty much. So it is, yeah. Oh, yes.
I was so moved by you receiving the food and having the opportunity to give. And what fell into my mind was that that it was that there wasn't any taking in it. That I was being given the opportunity just to give, and you were receiving exactly what we had to give, and so there's no taking. And just how the kind of relationship of reciprocity that's in taking the world exactly as it is and giving exactly what I am to the world. So I don't know.
That's so beautiful. Can I go on from there? What you just said encapsulates the path of enlightenment, because when we meditate and we discover in the breath, in the present moment, in our realization of the truth of the present moment, when we discover things just as they are, receive them just as they are, that's the greatest generosity we can give to ourselves. It's just, this is what the practice of receiving alms teaches us. Receive things just as they are. And then the training of the mind is to receive the things of the world, the experience of our mind, our body, exactly as it is, unconditionally. That receiving is a great generosity to ourselves, and it gives us the freedom, the true freedom that we are seeking. And so the joy that you experienced is a factor of enlightenment, because it brings so much joy to be so present for this breath, this moment, this truth. And then there is no more separation between our knowing of it and the truth itself. It's just gone.
Three hundred and eleven.
I just noticed that the clock says 4, and we have time for one more sit together. I think it would be so lovely. Let's take a little break, and we'll assemble in about 5 or 10 minutes.